Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be asking the question, as a DM, should you offer different subject matter to your players when the real world outside looks grim? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into it, everyone, I will remind you, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all of our patrons, and we invite you to join us. All you have to do to join in is visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. At the end of the show, maybe 10 minutes after the show is over, we will be hosting our live video chat there on the Discord server, and you can join in.
You know, we have a lovely, I'm glad you said that, Paul, because we have a lovely community of patrons on our Discord server. And for the past 7 years now, I mean, they've been a great source of support and inspiration for me and I hopefully to each other. And when people do have issues that they ask there, they usually get some great, great ideas for solutions in their game. So if you could, if you want to join us there, we would love to see you. And we'll see you in the video after chat at the end of the hour here, of course. So let me say something up front, and I think that both Paul and I sign off on this, and Paul can chime in if that's correct. So to be clear, you know, Paul and I both have friends and acquaintances who have very recently, very suddenly lost jobs, have family troubles that have popped up recently, immigration status revoked, legal complications, their gender status is suddenly threatened just recently, healthcare supports suspended, things like that. And to be very clear, Paul and I stand with all of those people. We wish them as much love and support and success as they can receive in their life. And we hope that things get better rather than worse in the mid to long term. So those are things that have been on our minds. And we have been wondering whether we need to run games or continue games differently as a result, or how best to support our friends and acquaintances. And I know that we're not alone about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say this is fresh on my mind, having just come from a gaming convention. And let's be honest, gaming, like any other entertainment, can be an escape when things are dark and foreboding, right? And so we want to provide that for ourselves and for our friends. And like I said, I was just very recently at a gaming convention where I just fell back to my usual behavior, which is to run several games of Fearful Ends, the horror RPG that I wrote well over a year now, that I love to run and introduce people to it and promote it by running it at game conventions. But I definitely had a moment at this last convention where I thought to myself, should I be running this? Do people want horror right now? I mean, I'll even say, let's see, right? Here we have, right here in the comments already, right? Kilroy says, I've had two separate groups say they don't want to do horror TTRPG stuff anymore because they're too stressed out over recent events in the last week.
Kilroy, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Good for you for listening to your players. I think, I mean, obviously, maybe that's just the first most obvious thing that any sensible person is going to do, is just listening to your players, that that's even an issue at this time is incredibly important. Maybe not something that I have been the best at in the past, so something that I'm trying to be more sensitive about rather than less nowadays. So good for you on that.
Now, partly this is coming up also because of a discussion in last week's episode that then spilled into our after chat. And I think specifically, I might be to blame here. Apologies, everyone. But I brought up in last week's episode the game Wander Home.
Let me pause you just for a second. I apologize for interrupting you. So just kind of on Kilroy's point, I will say, before we get into the wonderful, wonderful details here, that in the past couple of weeks for the games that I've been running regularly, I've made a mental note to myself that when I get there, you know, time is normally an issue in your gaming sessions. And sometimes I'm like, well, you know, we have our dinner and now's the time. And I try to get things started, kind of end side conversations. Like, we got to get started here, or we're not going to have enough time for the game. And I will say that for me, I've been going in mentally trying to be a little bit more flexible about that. Check in with how everybody's doing carefully. And, you know, if we have to have, if that's a night where we have to have a longer conversation, or like Kilroy's saying with our players, if we just abort the game that night and we're just going to have a check-in, I'm okay with that, unusually for me. And I was thinking that might, that hasn't happened yet, but I was thinking maybe that's a possible situation. And then to my surprise, I think it was two sessions ago, at the end of the night, one of the players said rather pointedly to me, said, you know, Dan, this is the only thing in my life that I've been looking forward to all week is this game. So that was extremely touching to me. And if I was frankly surprised by that, actually. And if I could do a tiny, just the tiniest little bit to brighten somebody's life in that week, that was a delightful gift for them to tell me that.
Yeah, that is really sweet. And that's, you know, honestly, hearing stuff like hearing positive reinforcement when you're spending the energy to set up and run games is delightful and reinforcing. And I would recommend anyone, like, yeah, appreciate your GMs, appreciate your fellow players. If you're having a great time and this is a valuable experience for you, you know, don't be stingy with your words of praise there. Why not?
Yeah,
that's great.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. So anyway, I was about to mention, and I'm not going to dig too deep into it right now, but I was about to mention that in last week's episode, I mentioned the game Wander Home, which has a very different tone than most games we talk about on this channel. And so much so, like, I hadn't realized that, Dan, that you hadn't even really heard of the game. And so as I was describe it very quickly, I think I kind of broke you. I broke some of our viewers. I almost took the show completely off the rails. We managed to get back on track and talk about the topic at hand, but then discussed it more in the after chat. So that's very interesting. And I'll have a lot to say about Wander Home as we push forward. And that kind of brings me to maybe two different things we can talk about here. One is the topic as written is, should you do this? Should you adjust your content based on the times? And then the latter part that we'll talk about, and the reason I'll bring up Wander Home, is how, you know, what games exist? How can we focus on other stuff? But yeah,
if you watched last week, I was very surprised. I had never heard of Wander Home, and it took me a while to understand what he was talking about.
Yeah. So I don't know, Dan. Do you want to dig more into the should you? Should you do this, or should you just bolt forward, run the game as always? I mean, I think that there's, you know, I don't know.
I want to follow up. And you know, this really crystallized. I didn't really understand why you were looking at Wander Home last week, and it really crystallized in the after chat. So it's another thing that I got to thank our patrons and our viewers that do join us in the after chat for letting us kind of explore this a little bit and getting some feedback before we did this week's show. So I'm happy for you to, like, maybe say out loud exactly why you're thinking about using Wander Home the way you are.
Yeah. Great. So Wander Home is a game by Jay Dragon, came out in, I believe, 21. So it's interesting, right? Also during a time of, frankly, a very dark time, right? Like, this is well into lockdown, right? COVID era. Okay. A lot of us were stuck in our houses. And role-playing games was one of the few, like, social activities that we found we could still engage in, right? There was a lot of people out there live streaming games. And Wander Home came out and was just absolutely beloved. It got such positive feedback at that time. It's not the sort of thing I would normally look for, but it was all over the place, frankly, in all of the gaming circles that I travel in. I kept hearing about it to the point where I thought, I gotta buy this game. I gotta find out what the heck this thing is about. And so I did. I have a copy here. I bought it. I've read through it. Honestly, it's a game I still struggle with to try and figure out how is this going to work. Now, I do actually intend to run it. I'm going to be playing it soon with some friends. But it is, like any game, as I always often say, like any game, it's an experiment, right? I don't know how this is going to go because it is an unusual game. And what is so unusual about it is the tone. It really is, you know, some people call it cottagecore or a cozy game. It is a game that really focuses on like soothing topics, calmness, enjoyment. Let's see. Let me read some sections here just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. So this is talking about the setting, and it says, in Haith, that's the name of the world it's set in, we'll be meeting people who are fundamentally good. This will not be true of all places you go in your life. Yep. But on the journey contained within this book, nearly everyone can be trusted to be kind. The exceptions are the mighty, generals, lords, heroes, soldiers, and all those whose souls have become weighed down by power. While they may still be good, that goodness has likely been poisoned by struggle. Thankfully, folks of this nature are exceedingly rare nowadays, and most everyone knows to give these lonely conquerors a wide berth.
Wow.
Right. So it talks a lot about that kind of setting of, like, you know, you're a wanderer. You're playing these anthropomorphic animals, and you're journeying around the world, and you're traveling from town to town, trying to find your way home for whatever that home means to you. And you're solving problems, but you're not solving problems. In fact, there's a whole chunk of text I have here as well that talks about how your goal is not to solve problems. You might encounter troubles. You might ease people's pain. But really, you're a wanderer, and you're just going to move on. It's got this very kind of pastiche feeling to it, right? Like this, you know, just this slice of life. Things happen, and then you travel, and you move on to the next place. And it really delights in these very homey, warm kind of settings.
You know, when you told me that, okay, so last week when you first told me that, I absolutely lost my marbles live. And the number one thing of, like, a cozy game that's not so much about combat, I think I've heard of things like that before, but then the additional fact that there's problems and you're not going to solve them. And I got to say, the amount of joy that itself, that your description just injected into my life, I am so glad that that's in the world for me to have heard about, because it's certainly something that my brain would never have come up with. And the fact that I was absolutely crippled with laughter itself makes me overjoyed that somebody invented that. So I'm so happy that got shared.
It's such a fascinating thing, because the thing that I struggle with most about this is the concept of if we like, when you talk to someone about what is a role playing game, right? What even is it? A lot of times you might fall back into words of, like, well, it's like shared storytelling. Right.
Yeah.
And me, my background, some folks may not know, but my degree is in creative writing. I have focused heavily into, you know, storytelling of one kind or another. And I definitely have it kind of drilled into my head that most stories, most narratives have this structure of introducing a conflict, resolving that conflict, right? Achieving a climax, and then a denouement. And this game sounds like there's no conflict, right? It kind of sounds like
exist.
And so I'm like, well, what is the game about now? Right? I struggle with, and to that end, not only did, after reading the book, the first thing I did is I went onto YouTube, but I started hunting for actual plays, because I was like, I got to see people play this game, because I don't understand what happens in it. What happens in this game?
Did you find actual plays of that?
Oh, plenty.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You know, even in the Inside Dust cover, there's a you know, a little nice little blurb written by Brennan Lee Mulligan of Dimension 20, who does have an actual play on YouTube. For folks who don't know, Dimension 20 is the biggest or the second biggest, depending on where you want to rank Critical Role, of actual play. Right? I think this very weekend, Brennan Lee Mulligan, this weekend, I believe, is running a live D&D game at Madison Square Garden for 20,000 fans. Yes. It is being billed as the largest live play game of D&D ever. Yeah.
What the? God damn. Jesus.
So, yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Lots of actual play out there. That. It is. Like I said, in 21, when everyone was online and stream, like, I feel like that's really when, like, live streaming games was because it was what we had left, right? So like,
yeah,
I think we saw a lot more live streaming games back then. So there's plenty of actual play to be had of Wanderhome on the intertubes.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Cool.
For me, I can imagine playing several sessions of it, and my question really will be, well, how long does it remain enticing for? At what point does it start to grow stale? And I don't know, you could ask that about any role-playing game, really. Right? I guess for me, when I'm trying to like time box a role-playing game, which sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, right? Some campaigns, they go on forever until we're bored with it and we decide to stop. But plenty of role-playing games I've run also, even in a campaign setting, I still like have a structure where I'm like, okay, well, when we get to this point, it will be the end and we will be done. I don't really feel like Wanderhome is ever done. And I think I get that impression from reading the book. And he's got some lovely little text blurbs where he just talks about his own experience running the game. And it sounds like this very casual, like people drop in or out. It has that whole setting, right, of we're just wanderers wandering from town to town. So, you know, players drop in and out and it's no big deal because the people you're traveling with change, right?
Okay. Fascinating. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, when you first mentioned the name, like, of course, to me, the Holmes D&D edition came to mind, which is what I started with. It doesn't sound like there has really any connection to that, but it's kind of interesting that it kind of at least echoes the very first D&D role-playing game that I ever got in the title. And I'll also say that serendipitously, I wound up playing Mouse Guard for the first time Friday night. I didn't run it, but a friend came in and said, I'd like to play something different for one night. And we actually played Mouse Guard for the first time. So I can say I played that now.
I think Mouse Guard, equally anthropomorphic animals. I know J. Dragon talks in Wanderhome a lot about being inspired by Redwall, the novel series by Brian Jacques, which I think Mouse Guard also leans heavily on. But I think Mouse Guard is a little more traditional adventure-y, isn't it? Isn't it a little more we're mice?
It is. Yeah. Descended from the Burning Wheel system. So I would, for my very first taste of it, I was surprised by how deep the mechanics were. So to my mind, a game where you're anthropomorphic mice feels like a small rule set, and kapow, out comes a 300-page hardcover book. It's in the zone of a third edition D&D kind of mechanical type stuff. Abilities and skills and this and that and inspiration and the other thing. So
where D&D fits in this spectrum, and there's you know, we're talking about like different tones of game, right? And there's all kinds of games out there with all kinds of different tones, and I feel like probably I was more reacting to the tone of horror than the tone of D&D, and we should talk a little bit about like what the tone of D&D is. Let me just share one other quick thing from Wanderhome, which is one of the reasons I brought it up. Which is the very concept of failure, Dan. Sorry, I'm trying to flip to the book here and get to the right section. I do have a thing to put on screen. There it is, found it. But I want it in front of me so I can read it from the book. Specifically, I'm going to compare some text here of the concept of failure as written by me in Fearful Ends versus as written by Jenny Dragon in Wanderhome. So at the top here, we have a blurb of text that I read out loud to everyone at the beginning of when I run Fearful Ends. And it says, "It is my goal that by the end of this game, every single player character is either dead or has completely lost their mind. We don't play to see if we'll succeed or fail. We know that failure is inevitable, and we play to relish the downfall of our characters." Right? Fearful Ends. It's specifically about characters losing their shit and just collapsing under the burden of the cosmic horrors they're encountering. Failure is inevitable. Here's a section randomly I found in Wanderhome. There's a whole section titled Failure. Here's his take on failure. "You might notice that nothing Wanderhome tells you to do concerns itself with failure. This doesn't mean you can't fail. Indeed, you can choose to fail whenever you'd like. Instead, Wanderhome as a game isn't preoccupied with failure. Often in life, we don't fail. Sometimes we struggle to do something, get passed over, do something we wish we hadn't, or give up. But even those moments aren't truly failures in a pejorative sense. Mistakes, maybe. Suffering at the cruelty of others. Listening to your body and your brain and accepting their natural limitations. But it doesn't mean you're a disaster, and it doesn't mean you failed. Your journey will just continue on another path." Again, not saying there is no failure, but just that the focus isn't on failure, and that we it's such an interesting difference in tone and approach to the game, I thought.
And there are games, so I brushed up on this in Mouse Guard, right? So I believe this is just descended from the Burning Wheel system. Is there, I will say, one of these games that says you never entirely fail? So we're trying to retrieve a lost letter and we're making a check. And if we succeed at the check, we get the letter and we escape completely scot-free. And if we fail the check, we get the letter, but there's a complication. And that is certainly a very different way of playing than I'm accustomed to. It's not my instinct for what game checks are like in either something like D&D or classic games like Star Frontiers that I'm currently running. So there's a number of games that obviously now slide where the failure. I mean, so what great examples you just read, Paul, of Fearful Ends, where failure is definitely the goal and guaranteed to happen, versus Wander Home, where we're neither interested in it nor do we cause nor do we require it to happen.
It's fascinating. Right? So I think that's interesting. Like when we talk about, if I'm going to take a step back a little bit and talk about the should we, right? Should we change the tone of our games based on the state of the world? I think the interesting thing is that D&D, which is often the focus of our conversation here on the show, is in the middle, I think, of that tonal spectrum, right? You have games like Wander Home, which are clearly, you know, very cozy and warm and reassuring. And then you have games like Fearful Ends or other horror games. Somebody else, I think, in the chat mentioned, like, I don't want to currently play any, I've lost the name of it, and now it scrolled off. Cyberpunk, right? Like the dystopian future, right? Like, I don't want to dwell in dystopia.
I think maybe about 48 hours ago, just in a casual conversation, I said something very similar to that, with a lot of spicy words. You know, the top shelf, top shelf of my bookcase right there is mostly all cyberpunk literature, right? That was influential to me at a time. We have run a minimal cyberpunk game on the channel in the past here at Wandering DMs. And I've been looking at some of the stuff that Bruce Sterling, who's one of the main authors, has been writing recently, and it's a little too close. Like, frankly, here's what I said. I said, My main complaint with the cyberpunk authors now is they nailed it too accurately.
I can definitely empathize with the desire to maybe not dwell in cyberpunk fiction right now.
Yeah.
But what about D&D? D&D is fantasy adventure. It can range anywhere from like high fantasy epic save the world to like low fantasy, ne'er-do-wells trying to make a buck, but it's still adventuresome, right? It's defeat the monsters, find treasure. How does that fit?
It's obviously the biggest tent role-playing game. The intent is to be there for everybody, kind of for all things, to be kind of kitchen sink. And at the outset, you can see there's comedy elements and there's pun names and pun magic items and spells and stuff like that. So I agree. It clearly, D&D has the biggest range, and depending on how you structure an adventure or run it as DM or with your players, it could be anywhere on that continuum. You know, one thing I want to say, Paul, that we stumbled into in the after chat last week was that you and I both took film classes in college at different colleges, obviously. And we both got the message from our instructors at one point that in particular historical eras, the taste in movies changes a lot. And the tones of the art and the movies that are coming out in response to that, you can see possibly radically shift. Am I remembering that you got that message in your course?
Yep. And absolutely.
And one
I remember a lot of discussion of the shift from noir in the 40s into more like four-color heroism in the 50s or late 40s, right? World War II, essentially.
Yes, yes.
Kind of shifted that.
And one thing that came to mind, so I was actually screened for us in my class was this film called Sullivan's Travels, which always sticks in my mind a lot, which is a, thank you for that, which is a 1941 Preston Sturges film. So it's just at the outset of World War II, for what it's worth. Black and white in sound and at the time, and basically, okay, so spoiler to an 85-year-old movie. Sorry, everybody. And so basically, so Sullivan is a Hollywood director, is a big Hollywood director, and his goal at the outset is he wants to make a socially relevant, important artistic drama is what he wants. Little side point: in the fiction, he wants to film a version of a fictional book called "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?" Actually, which then inspired the later George Clooney movie, for what it's worth. And so what he does in order to do research is he disguises himself as a hobo and decides to go on a road trip through America to see how the poor people live, basically. And at the end of it, he accidentally gets accused of a crime, arrested, thrown into a chain gang, and then winds up having done hard labor with the criminals there, wound up the one piece of respite they have in the week is they go into a church and they're shown a Disney cartoon. And he sees everybody laughing and enjoying themselves for the only time in the week. And he comes away with a very different point of view. And I guess near the end of the film at that point, he says, there's a lot to be said for making people laugh. Did you know that's all some people have? So fairly influential, all things considered. And that's definitely the theme that Sturges gives in Sullivan's Travels. And I believe he said, you know, outside the film, that this was something of a critique, something of a criticism of people trying to do big, important art films. And this was kind of his response to it right in 1941. And that's always stuck in my mind a lot.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah. It's a legitimate film. I remember really being, you know, entertained and thought it was really well done when I saw it at the time. Yeah.
I'll have to look it up and give it a view myself. I've never seen it. So that sounds really fascinating.
Yeah. I think it is.
And what is ultimately the tone of that film? Like, would you come away from it as feeling like this was light entertainment, or this was, you know, an important, you know, moral message, or something in between? Or
now this one, okay, I saw it quite a while ago. It's going to feel like screwball comedy until he gets arrested, and I feel it's one. I don't know what I should compare it to, but I feel like the last third of it is you're surprised by how dark it gets. Is what I recall. So it's like, haha, you know, act one, screwball comedy, act two, screwball comedy. And then he's arrested. And all of a sudden you're like, what movie have I just gotten dipped into? which I appreciate, frankly.
That's fascinating. That's interesting.
Now I just spoiled the twist for everybody, but that was my experience of it.
Let me give another, let me take us in a slightly different direction about RPGs with different tone. Because this is the other thought I had, right, when I was reacting to, and we'll take this into context and come back and talk about D&D some more. So when I was originally thinking, like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be running Fearful Ends, right? Like, maybe the horror is too much right now. What direction can I go? And of course, I thought of Wanderhome and I started looking into that, like cozy, warm. But also, you could go another direction, which is heroic, right? Which is what I remember my lesson from film class being like, you know, as World War II takes hold, we start to see more movies about larger than life heroes, right? Superman comes out, right? Those kind of characters start emerging, right?
40s.
So there are certainly games, like, there's plenty of superhero games, right? You could run a supers game. This is maybe a weird dark twist on it, but I have Necessary Evil, which I've always wanted to run.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not quite what you want, but you could certainly do just like a four color, you know, superheroes. The other game I have that I think fits the bill pretty well is Thirsty Sword Lesbians. I don't know if you know this game, well, Dan.
I have. You're not surprising me with Thirsty Sword Lesbians, Paul. Of course I know about that.
Excellent. So I'll read it real quick, and I don't have a text to put on the screen for this one, but real quick here, here's a little thing about, in the introduction text to try and give you the tone of the game, it says, whether it's an entire planet, a knightly order, or just the coven to which the protagonists belong, they are part of a community that embodies important ideals worth fighting for, even as you strive to make it better. Right? So you could make a game that is, well, yes, there's unpleasantness in the world, and we're going to run a game that is about overcoming that, right? Yeah. We're going to be the heroes that the world needs right now.
Yeah. And to be clear, that at the root, that's not D&D, right? D&D is certainly, many people say murder hobos. Frequently thieving, shiftless, seedy, semi-criminals in the Fafford Grey Mouser mold. So that imprint wasn't exactly, stamped on D&D from the outset.
Agreed, except I think it's easy to take it that way when just by leaning into the Tolkien influence, right? You look at Lord of the Rings, right? And Lord of the Rings, I've often heard, was, written about or influenced by World War II, right? There's a lot, I've heard theories, right, that the ring is essentially the atom bomb, and that yeah, okay,
And I think we know that Tolkien himself argued against that, but the influences seems very, the change in tone between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings is so sharp that you've got to embrace the fact that the state of the world changed how he was writing. Yep.
So you could lean into heroics, and I think that the thing about leaning into heroics is that it cuts both ways, right? On the one hand, yes, we're giving our players this chance to embody what they want to see in the world. They can make a positive change on this fantasy world, and that feels good. But the downside is you've got to role play the problems that they're overcoming, and there will be cases where sometimes the bad guys get the upper hand, and maybe that feels too real.
Yeah. Yes, I hear that. And, and frankly, this is not, this has been a lifelong, it's so interesting that when I was a young person, I had enormous personal trouble, like around Halloween, real problems a couple times. And, in later years, my mother rather notably asked me, she says, I can't synthesize, Dan, why you have such a problem with, masks and goblins and things like that when you were growing up. And then your entire hobby is to portray that in great numbers at a gaming table. And that was kind of a thinker for me. And I'm like, well, when I'm on this side of it, I kind of see the backstage version of it, which takes some of the edge off for me. I'm kind of in control of it. And to break the kayfabe, the answer is, I'm setting this up for the players to destroy the evil. That's what I want to see. And I try to play fair, and I try to set it up that they can, that it is challenging. Player characters do expire in my games, obviously. But the reason why I kind of grab on to explicit rules, as I've said, is I really don't trust myself that in a moment of weakness, I'm just going to give the game away. But in my heart of hearts, I'm rooting for the player characters, and I'm setting up these evil things to be destroyed. And it's good for me to see that.
Yeah, that is, I mean, I think we've talked about that on this on this show before, right? That's the dirty secret of the killer DM is that we delight in watching the players actually win, right? Yeah. That there's
I'm not kidding, if I set up a challenge and they break it too easily and I flip out, right? I think that my players are entertained by that.
Let me just to go back to the, like, is it, I don't know, is it good? right, or not, to have those kind of stories. Like, I guess I would still lean into, like, it cuts both ways, right? I think you're still going to have some players who are like, yeah, I'd love those scenes where I get to overcome and win, but, like, having to actually have moments at the table where we dwell in the bad guys and their plots, right? Like, that is too real for me. And, I think that's just a case of, like, you're just going to have to check in with your players and see, you know. I guess what I would say is, now more than ever, you should be checking in and talking about this stuff up front before just jumping into a game. Talk to your players, right? Find out what they have stomach for and what they don't, because...
I hear that. Now,
yeah.
People should listen to Paul. Great point. admittedly, that's not my first go-to. I do like to surprise players, and there's certainly a dilemma between how much surprise and how much check-in do you do. I would, in addition to Paul's point, I would emphasize, really watch and listen your players at the table. And if someone starts to withdraw or someone starts to be disconnected, if you're really present and honest, I think you can usually see that. And I think that you can respond or reorient in a sensible, responsible fashion. So I do think that I am trying to be a little bit more observational about, is everybody actually okay and engaged? I'm sure I'll make a mistake someday, but I feel like just not steamrolling them. If you're present, you can see if someone's having a problem and you can respond to it.
You know, we did an episode not too long ago about safety tools. And in fact, I spoke on safety tools recently at the Eurasia Game Convention. And this might be an interesting take on why maybe you want to include some safety tools in your game. The GM, yes, I totally agree with what you're saying, Dan. As the game runner, you should be watching your players and reading them and trying to figure out, like, when you've maybe pushed into content that is troublesome. But that's hard, right? As depending on the number of people at the table, you might miss it, right? So I would say that it maybe consider incorporating one or two safety systems into your game, just to get that extra check in place, to give a mechanical way for players to jump in and say, I'm not comfortable with where this game is going.
If that works for your play group, 100%, and you get additional security out of that, 100%, obviously you should do that.
Yeah.
Paul, can I make, okay, I would like to make a counter argument before the hour is
Great.
Up.
Let's hear it. Yeah.
On the overall issue of, should you change the tone? And kind of spinning off the story that we both got in our college film classes about the tone changes in bad times. So number one is, and I kind of have two, this is a play in two acts, Paul. So act number one is that the pulp fiction fantasy that inspired D&D, its boom golden era was exactly in the Depression and World War II, the 30s and 40s. So if you look at Appendix N in the first edition DM's Guide, and you look at the paragraph that says these are the biggest, most immediate influences on D&D, they all were having their boom era basically in the Depression, which is when the pulp fiction era was at its height. And so on the one end, you had people like Lovecraft and maybe A. Merritt, who were in the, I guess I would say, the autumn of their careers. So, you know, Lovecraft wrote Call of Cthulhu on about 1925, like about 4 years before the Depression. And his largest body of work was happening in the 30s, in the Depression era, right up until he passed away in 1937. Robert E. Howard's entire corpus was basically the worst part of the Depression. So Robert E. Howard didn't actually publish anything until like the year that the Depression started. And then the entirety of everything that we know about Robert E. Howard, Conan and Solomon Kane and Kull, is basically overlaps the Depression era up until he passed away in 1936, I guess. Which kind of blows my mind that the entire Robert E. Howard Conan work is just 4 years. right? Unbelievably. And then you had Elsbrig de Camp was getting his start in that same era. Fritz Leiber was getting that his same start in that era. So all of the crazy, weird fantasy, science fiction, adventure, lost worlds, adventure type stuff, thieving, you know, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser came up in that exact same era. And basically that was where the boom of this whole fiction was exactly in the 30s Depression era. And to my understanding, it only really tapered off because of paper shortages in World War II.
I know you're leading somewhere here, Dan, and I don't want to cut that off. But just interesting, the thing that entered my mind is exactly reiterated here by our viewer Jerry McDonald, who says once again horror was bigger in the 20s and fantasy takes over in the 30s. And I think that's what was clicking in my head as you were talking about that is. Well, gosh, you know, the horror that Lovecraft is writing is during the roaring 20s when everything is great, right? Everything, party time and booming economies and etc. And then as the Great Depression hits us, then we start to see these larger than life heroics, right? Conan, Cull.
Well, okay. I'm going to hear that. I'm going to respectfully slightly differ. Conan's not a great hero. Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser are not great heroes. And Lovecraft was absolutely, sure, he got starred in the 20s, but he was actually finding greater success in the Depression era 30s.
I agree that Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser are not quite the big horse, but Conan is much larger than life. He's basically Superman, fantasy Superman, right?
He's not dedicated to truth and justice in the American way. It's true.
Yeah. But he's still
larger than life.
He does the right thing, and he's more powerful than everyone else. And
we need an episode where we debate this.
Maybe.
What's Conan's alignment? okay. Anyway, okay.
Where were you going with all this? Yeah.
Good points.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That the root of D&D, the root of you know where you know D&D comes from was fundamentally in the worst of times, the Depression and World War II is exactly when these people were either getting started or having their boom years. Okay, you don't like that. Maybe we'll debate that in a later time. Now
I thought I was agreeing with you. I mean, the funny thing is, I thought I was agreeing with you, right? Conan never fails, right? We go back to the failure thing. He doesn't fail. He always succeeds. He always wins the day. Yeah,
that's
he's
true.
Very much a counter to the grueling existence of the Great Depression when you know everything is a struggle, and you frequently don't get your needs met.
Super well put. That's true. And you fundamentally have the freedom. There's treasures out there to be had. I think that's a good point. The whole sword and sorcery genre was invented at that time. Okay. Now the other thing I will point out, and look, I'm not the biggest aficionado of all, but many people will point to that same time, the Depression 30s and 40s, as the golden era of the monster movie. And that is when the Universal Studio monster movies had their boom era, and it started, 1931, 1932, just before the Depression started, with the Bela Lugosi Dracula film and the Boris Karloff Frankenstein film and The Mummy the next year. And so obviously they put their stamp, the iconic way that we think about Dracula and Frankenstein and the Mummy, like in our D&D games, came from exactly that era. And their initial heyday was in the 30s, and they had a really big boom in Universal monster movies in the 30s. Interestingly, 1933, which was kind of a key year, had this weird glut of mad scientist movies. So all in 1933, you had Dr. Moreau and the Island of Lost Souls. You had Dr. Griffin. You had The Invisible Man with Dr. Griffin. And you had Mystery of the Wax Museum that all had these like maniacal masterminds all using science for bad ends all at the exact same moment. And so that boom in Universal Monster movies, to my understand, would have continued except for the Hays Code that kind of clamped down on those themes. But then 1941 comes around, the U.S. enters World War II, and then they have an even bigger boom. The single biggest boom in universal horror monster movies was exactly overlapping with the World War II era, starting with Lon Chaney Jr. and the Wolfman. And they made twice as many, you know, and there were a lot of sequels and there were a lot of remakes and stuff like that. But they had twice as many movies come out exactly contemporaneously with World War II. So I think I can understand, you know, the audience is not monolithic. And I think I can understand that some people are going to want to see heroes or musical numbers or something like that. But there are some other people that do, you know, find horror to be escapist or a way that they can get a grip on bad things in the world or talk about things maybe in a coded way when it's necessary for certain people. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting that actually the single biggest boom in the Universal horror era is exactly 1941 to 1945.
Yeah. So the question I think that is maybe being debated in the chat right now a little bit is, are these monster movies that were booming at this time, are they generally all stories where in the end our hero defeats the monster?
I was reading up on people that are smarter about horror movies than I am, and one of them made the point that interesting, and it's interesting that this goes back so far, is that one of the themes that Universal hit on that audiences responded to is that all the monsters are somewhat sympathetic. All those famous monsters are a result of some kind of accident. Something bit them, something created them, something cursed them, and they're not entirely to blame for their own state. So in all those cases, they're at least partly sympathetic, and they come back later, okay? But in the original movies, yes, they all expire, and it's kind of a melancholic doom that's fallen upon them.
Interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
And they've caused tragedies, but they've also received tragedies. And a lot of people say that that's one of the things that people were responding to that made those movies such big hits is that complication.
Is the argument then that simply we are reflecting the state of the world in a disattached way so that we can process and cope with it?
I think that is part of the statement, and I think that the creators wanted to talk about things. And this fantasy way was the one way that it seemed feasible to them. And I think there's a lot of historical episodes where that was the case. I mean, I'm a fan of our D&D, our role-playing games, being about something else. As I've said many times, I'm not a super big fan of D&D just being about D&D and being entirely inward-looking. I kind of like D&D to be referring to things outside itself, and I don't mind that as a usage.
In terms of whether or not the role playing game is as a mechanism for us, so whether it should or should not reflect the tone of what's happening in the real world, I feel like there's like I'm struggling to put my thoughts together here. There's I feel like the complaint I often hear, right, when the role-playing game is starting to elicit emotions from us that are unpleasant, you know, or reactions from us that are unpleasant because of the state of the world, often the complaint is worded as, it's too real, right? It's too real. It's too close to reality. Right. And it's interesting to me that I can kind of hear us talking about two different ways of dealing with that. One is we'll go a totally different direction. Right. We're going to have our fantasy be about cozy and warm things or heroics or something other than dealing with the reality. Total escapism, total head in the sand, kind of. That's maybe a pejorative, but you know what I mean. Right. Like, avoid it at all costs. And the other mechanism is make it less real. The content is still present. but make it less real so that it is more distant from me so that I can process it and deal with it and not be like, oh, that's like my life and I don't want my life in this game. Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is that it makes it might make sense to be more fantastical of we're not going to be talking about actual mad scientists. We're not going to talk about actual mad technologists. We're going to talk about someone who made a cursed mummy instead, and maybe that palimpsest makes it easier to practice grappling with that.
Yeah. Or maybe even, right? Like, I don't want, political rulers in my fantasy world that are too like the political rulers in our real world. But I do like there being an evil sorcerer, you know, that I can overcome that has some parallels, but isn't so on the nose that I'm going, oh, well, you're just talking about a person in the real world.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, I think there's at least an argument for both directions, right? And I think that your point about listening to the players is paramount. And I think that your palette at this time in these kinds of times could possibly include both. If you have a group that specifically says, I don't want to do any cyberpunk, I don't want to do any horror, bam, it's gone, no problem.
To relate how this has come up in my actual life, here's where I'm at right now, right? I have not run an ongoing campaign of any role-playing game in some time. Most of my gaming these days happens as one-shots, either because of conventions or parties or whatnot. So I haven't had an ongoing campaign in quite a long time, as it turns out. And I've been thinking about that and thinking about how I would like one right now. Right now, especially, I would like a weekly or bi-weekly or periodic thing of a social chance to get together with my friends and partake in a fictional world that is just something I can look forward to, right? Week by week, day by day, I can look forward to this event to go hang out with my friends and play a game, and I would really like that back in my life. And when I think about, well, how do I form that up? And I think about all of the mechanisms I've used to run games in the past, run campaigns in the past. Usually I immediately start thinking about, well, what content, what game, what system? But instead right now, what I find myself thinking is, let me find people who I know are reliable. Let me find people who live close by so it's easy for them to get to. Let me form a group. And then I'm going to actually engage that group and say, what kind of game do we want to play? What feels good to all of us to engage in on a bi-weekly basis?
That's great. Yeah. It's interesting that I have had an overly, I think this week I just hit the 1 year point actually on my Star Frontiers game. And I did not expect it to be lasting this long. And I've accidentally stumbled into a campaign that feels that it's kind of like breathing and growing as I go on, which is something I kind of always wanted. And I don't think I've ever nailed it as hard is what I have at the moment. And it's been a nice surprise that we can rely on it. And we kind of are familiar with the characters now. And we're kind of familiar with the milieu at this point. There's play of like me dangling like, oh, here's a native tribe. And like one of the things that I've gotten from the players has been, we keep expecting this to be really cringy, a really cringy take on like native peoples, and it keeps not being that. Like, to our surprise, it's like we like everybody, we like all the native peoples that we've run into in really different, fresh ways, and we all feel really good about that. And that has been like one of the little surprises that's kind of nice. I'm like, well, you could, you know, you have a right, you could take a license and just take all their property, and it would be very valuable for mining rights. And they're like, what kind of asshole would do that? So that's kind of been a theme that I've just tossed in like a couple, like kind of routinely once in a while. And that's kind of been, it's kind of been a nice thing to touch base that we agree on what the good things and the bad things are.
Do you foresee this campaign going on for another year?
Now it's exceeded my expectations, and now I'm starting to not know the campaign was, a pre-written, like, here's the beginning, here's the ending. And now I don't know where it's going, frankly. So I don't know, Paul. I'm starting to be as surprised as anybody.
I'm envious that you got there. That's a fun place to be.
I agree. It's nice. Yep. You know, okay, so one thing, let's talk a little bit about things that people are going to see on the channel in the upcoming, because we have, but Paul and I are both having a little bit of a creative outburst at the moment. So one thing you're going to, one little thing you're going to see, you're going to see some shorts on the channel from me and my partner when we visited the battleship New Jersey a couple weeks ago, actually. And we, you know, we talk about ships. One of my main gaming goals is to have a naval addition, a properly structured naval addition to our Book of War game. So I'm always investigating and researching, you know, ships and stuff like that. So one of the things that I saw when we visited the battleship New Jersey, and I have an image for this, Paul, is the Ten Commandments of Damage Control. So Ten Commandments of Damage Control, and you can pause this, you can read it in full on your own. And one of the things I want to emphasize here is this is not fiction, right? This is actual battle-tested rules for keeping your battleship in World War II afloat. And the couple things that I want to highlight are, like, number three, have confidence in your ship's ability to withstand severe damage. That's what it's built for, right? Yep. And I also want to emphasize, like, go ahead, Paul. You have a comment on that?
No, it's just great.
And then I want to emphasize the culmination at the end is the last three items. Number eight, practice personal damage control. Protect yourself so you can protect your ship. I agree with that. Number nine, take every possible step to save the ship as long as any bit of hope remains. Now, notice that they're admitting that ships go down sometimes. There is a point where you need to recognize no hope remains, but it's gonna hang on. Do everything you can until that is the point. And then number 10, keep cool. And in red, don't give up the ship. Don't stay cool. Freaking out doesn't help. Protect yourself, number one. Then you can help protect the ship. And I thought, I was really struck by that. And I endorse the Battleship New Jersey's Commandments of Damage Control.
That is delightful. I can't help, right, but immediately start to think of my brain is just trained to click over into, like, paranoia. Don't panic. Keep your laser handy. Oh, man. Okay, but no, you're right. The funny thing is, I will say, I know it's talking about protecting a battleship or damage control of a battleship, but yeah, so much of this you could just easily apply to, like, the battleship is your own mental health, and it translates pretty darn well,
right? Right. I was really struck by that.
That's amazing.
Those are people actually fighting World War II.
Yeah, we're out of time, Dan. Any final thoughts on adjusting the tone of your role playing game based on the realities of the world outside?
Well, I like I said, I think my takeaway is that you kind of have a broad range of colors on your palette, and the root of D&D, and I frequently say the root of D&D is really horror, actually comes out from those Depression era days, those Depression era World War II days. So, but more important than anything, of course, listen to your players, you know, observe your players, try to find joy. Take care, as a DM, we have a lot of responsibility. Take care of your players. Keep cool. Yeah, protect yourself so you can protect your ship.
That is fantastic. Yeah, I would say my takeaway is that, you know, now more than ever, community is incredibly important, and local community especially. If you have a group of people who you can get together with regularly, whether that's in person or online, protect that group, right? Find out, talk to them, engage them in what is going to feel good, because I think, you know, media of any kind, whether it's movies or books or TV shows or role-playing games, are an important way for us to both escape reality and to process reality. And doing so, the fascinating thing about doing so in a role-playing game context is that it becomes a social engagement, not just a personal thing. So lean in. I would say lean in. Don't just say, well, we can't play. Lean in and find out what your players need and build the game around that.
I've said forever, people heard me say this a lot, D&D is not just fun. It's way more important than that.
Excellent. Viewers, if you have thoughts on other tones of role-playing games we could check out, or opinions on how to adjust the tone of your role-playing game based on the realities of the world around us, please post us some comments here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe your thoughts will provoke more deep thoughts from us, just as this very show was inspired by conversations by our viewers. Inspire us again, please, and the show will continue on in wonderful, delightful ways.
Super well put, Paul. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub by the handle Wandering DMs. We have that handle on all those sites, so please look for us there and batten down that like button.
If you prefer to listen to the show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us on one of those sites right now and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, like we've been saying, huge thanks to our patrons who continue to support the show. We could not do what we're doing without your support and, frankly, your inspiration every week. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues round the clock about old school D&D and new school D&D and science fiction, miniatures, and community building with your game group and all kinds of stuff like that. We'll be there in about 10 minutes or so to continue the chat here in our video after chat. And we love touching base in person with some of our patrons. So, Paul, now some of our folks, I think at the beginning of this hour, had noticed a notification for a different kind of show that you're going to be doing tomorrow night. Tell me about that.
Yes, tomorrow night I will be live streaming myself playing a game of basic BX Moldvay era D&D with a very unusual DM. My DM is Martha the AI. That is a custom AI that I have prepared to run a game of D&D for me. This is kind of an extension of one of the most popular shows on our channel to date. Is a very short, like 5-minute video I posted 5 years ago at posing the question, can you play D&D alone? Right. And at that time, we went over a lot of the options available, solo modules, that sort of other like one player games, that kind of thing. And TSR has tried this many different ways. And I think you and I have explored this ad infinitum in this channel of, you know, whether it's, magic viewers or choose your own adventure style or whatnot. But the thought struck me recently because of my experience. I currently work for a software company that is an AI company. How has that changed now that AI is available? Can we use AI to play D&D solo? Does it even count as solo at that point if you're playing with an AI? So I'm going to experiment with it. We're going to find out the hard way together. I'm going to run a game. I've done a few early experiments, but I'm going to actually sit down tomorrow night with the AI and try to get it to run me through a basic D&D game. We're going to see how it goes.
The question that immediately comes to my mind is, can Paul produce something in his spare time that is better than what Wizards of the Coast can produce?
Is Wizards of the Coast pursuing this? Is that a thing?
I think they said that in the past. I thought that's what they said. There are...
I certainly have friends who have experimented with this. I've heard success stories of folks running other role-playing games with AI at the helm. I've learned a lot about what AI is good at and what it's not good at. And I'll be going over that in the show. And before we even get going, I'll do a little talk for 5 minutes or so about the limitations and the expectations of what I have of the AI's capabilities. And then we'll experiment and see how it goes.
I like a good science experiment, so I am really excited about seeing that. So that's tomorrow, Monday, 7 p.m. Eastern time, right?
That's right.
And, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't remind viewers that you and I are going to be at Rising Phoenix Con at the end of April 25th through 27th. And of course, we'll be doing one of our dungeon design dashes live in a seminar Friday. And then you and I will both be, we don't know what it is yet, but we're going to be running it the following days for some players. So if folks look for us there, we would love to have you join us.
Yeah, the Dungeon Design Dash, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is an episode where Dan and I try to stock an entire dungeon in a single episode. Sometimes it takes two. we try to, as quickly as possible, fill out an entire adventure. And it's been very well received. Folks seem to like it. And we get a lot of audience participation through the chat. And I think we thought, well, would it be interesting to run this in front of a live audience? How would that change things? So most specifically, I guess what I want to mention, Dan, is absolutely, if you can come to Rising Phoenix Game Con, please come April 25th to April 27th. Our seminar is 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern, Friday, the 25th. And we will be live streaming that. Hopefully, provided that the infrastructure of the hotel supports us. But we will be doing our best to live stream that. So if you can't make it to the con, still absolutely do please come and watch us. You'll get you'll at least get to see us do another Dungeon Design Dash and maybe enjoy some of the craziness of doing that in front of a live audience.
And now I know, I'm so glad that I just discovered we're going to be live streaming. That's fantastic. So in the improv community, there's a statement of step into the fear, and that's what we're going to be doing that weekend.
Yep.
So wait.
Yep, absolutely.
Awesome. So look for us there. Don't forget about Paul tomorrow night, 7 p.m. for a brand new way of running D&D, hopefully. I'll look forward to that. And of course, don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We really hope you'll join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.